better put him in the Heisman.
Got that wood right here, baby.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Bud Light Seltzer, for those anytime easy drinking occasions.
They're going to run and get that boot.
The Arkansas Razorbacks have completed the dream season.
A baseball team that's on the way back, a College World Series title. Stadium.
I almost got fired because I went Willie the Boss after I had a little too much sauce.
This is the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast.
So when you think about what started Arkansas basketball, your first love, many of you listening right now to the program, it started with Eddie Sutton. The Arkansas legend, the Kentucky legend, the Oklahoma State legend passed away at the age of 84. This weekend. And I thought Andy did a really good job with the article on hitthatline.com talking about how Eddie Sutton really was the architect for fans loving basketball inside this state. This will always be a football first state. But like Norm DeBrien, like Dave Van Horn, Eddie Sutton was the guy that took another sport in Arkansas to new heights with the basketball program. And it's because of great players like Sidney Moncrief, Marvin Delph, Ron Brewer, Scott Hastings, Joe Klein, and on and on and on. Some of these great players, some of these great teams that he had helped elevate the program, not only inside the state of Arkansas, but across the board. Across college basketball, where you got to a level of respect, and that was elevated tremendously. And there is so much gratitude and debt that is owed towards that man and what he was able to do for the Arkansas basketball program. And a real bummer, we'll get into this coming up, is he's not going to see his own induction down here on Earth to the Hall of Fame. And I know a lot of his former players, his family, are really bummed that that's not going to happen. It's exciting to see that he was selected for the Hall of Fame, but unfortunately, he will not get to see his own induction.
The shame is the selection happened so late in his life that his health was not good enough for him to actually give the speech. You know, 10 years ago, he could have given a wonderful Eddie Sutton speech at the Hall of Fame as part of the ceremonies. But unfortunately, it came at the, literal final days of his existence here on Earth. And we are all the worse for it. Eddie Sutton knows that he passed on back with his wife Patsy up in heaven knowing that happened. He wasn't going to be able to give the speech anyway. We are all the losers of the fact that we're not going to get to hear it in his own words. But nonetheless, it was long overdue. Glad it happened. And, for a lot of people, unless you're in your 50s, you probably don't have a great recollection of Coach Sutton's time here at Arkansas. You're like, I remember it a little bit, but I was a kid when that happened. You've read about it. You weren't around for any of it. I remember Eddie Sutton more from Oklahoma State than I do anything else.
Two Final Fours at OSU.
Because that was just more my time in the 90s getting to really pay attention. Watching Bryant Reeves, who's from just across the Oklahoma border from where we're at, over near Gans. Who went over and was, Big Country was one of his critical players in those great teams he had over there. So that's what I really remember Eddie Sutton for. It's not Arkansas. I knew he was there because I was a big Joe Klein fan, watched him play. I watched those games, but I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old when all that happened. What I really remember is Oklahoma State. And I, on a couple of rare occasions, early in my officiating career, we went to Oklahoma State every year. There's still a camp there that they have every year that when Coach Sutton was the coach there, and got to visit with him and Coach Dickey and those guys and on just for a few minutes. So that was, I've had a few brief interactions with Coach Sutton. Wonderful man, and the world of basketball, sure going to miss him.
Speaking of Coach Dickey, James Dickey, former assistant coach under Eddie Sutton, is going to join us at 7:15 this morning. Clay Henry's going to join us at 7. Clay, unlike us, has great perspective, not only from his past experiences, but just his overall knowledge of Arkansas basketball covering over the years. So we'll get some great insight from Clay Henry coming up on this subject. Really excited about that. If you have a favorite Eddie Sutton memory, a favorite Eddie Sutton player, you can get on the conversation, 877-377-6963 at any point this morning. 11 years with the Arkansas Razorback program, and my goodness, was it hard to win at home against the Razorbacks during his time. You think about his winning percentage in Fayetteville, 938. He lost 8 games in Fayetteville, 120-8. 120-8 in Fayetteville, the highest winning percentage of any head coach to step in the doors. It's not like Nolan's was a slouch when it came to winning at home at Barnhill and Bud Walton Arena, but that goes to show you the home court advantage that Eddie Sutton and his basketball teams had when people came into Barnhill Arena. And I was watching a bunch of KAT archives last night, just listening to some of the stuff and trying to get as much knowledge and as much background on this conversation before entering today. It was just fascinating to just read up on what Eddie Sutton, the fact that he'd had success at Creighton, Arkansas, Kentucky, Oklahoma State, particularly Arkansas and Oklahoma State. He was just marvelous at so many different things. And you think about his former players. We'll get into some conversations coming up of what Joe Klein had to say about him, U.S. Reed, Sidney Moncrief, who have all appeared on this program, and the great things they've said about their former basketball coach and just not only what he did for them on the court, but off the court as well.
Yeah, and he made Razorback, Nolan obviously took it to the next level and won the national title, but I've got serious doubts any of that happens without the foundation that was laid by Eddie
Sutton. Very similar to what Norm did for Dave. There's a very similar comparison.
That's exactly what I was getting ready to say, that the foundation had been laid and Norm had taken teams to the College World Series. Very similar situation with the passing of the torch from Eddie to Nolan back in the mid-80s. Nolan doesn't have the success. Doesn't make the Final Four in 1990. Probably doesn't get the second set of triplets with Todd Day, Lee Mayberry, Oliver Miller. Those type of players probably weren't coming here if it hadn't have been for the foundation laid by Eddie Sutton. So, because they took over, Eddie took over a program that Larry Van Enum had just been horrendous, and Arkansas had like one winning season in 9 or so, some numbers like that. Arkansas basketball had basically been irrelevant for the 50s, 60s, and half of the 70s till Eddie got here, after being a program that was making Final Fours and had some success in the 40s. But really, when Arkansas's heyday in football came along, the basketball program was an afterthought, and they played that way.
9 NCAA tournaments in his 11 seasons at Arkansas, 1 Final Four, was the National Coach of the Year, both 77 and 78, consistently got that team to the Southwest Conference appearances. I mean, they were just consistently really, really good. And honestly, as Tommy mentioned, as I mentioned, the best comparison you can make as far as laying the foundation is the exact same thing you're seeing with the baseball program. And the success that Nolan Richardson had, as much as he is credited for that, you don't know if it would be the same without Eddie Sutton, and it's very important for the history of Arkansas basketball and the projection where you hope you can get back to is that Eddie Sutton was your former basketball coach.
You said 9 of 11 NCAA tournaments, but we also need to point out that wasn't the day and time where you had 64 teams or 68 teams in the field. It's 32, I believe, for part of that, and then expanded to 48 during his time. So this wasn't a day and time, Ty, where, you know, even a third of the teams out there made the tournament. So it's even more difficult to do what he did at that clip.
Yeah, he was able to do that despite not as many teams as Tommy mentioned getting in, which is very important.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a premium light lager brewed with real lemonade.
Now he does a tightrope act. Boy, Houdini's in the house. We're number 3, and nobody's home to watch that house. Touchdown!
Clay, before we get into these stories from former players, we've got a question here from Brad in Mountain Home a while back asking you, you've already shared some great stories, some great points about Eddie Sutton. Is there a personal story that you've experienced face-to-face or just at a game that stands out to you as your favorite Eddie Sutton story?
Well, I think one about his generosity. When I was first getting to know him, I was the sports editor at at the log cabin Democrat in Conway, and Marvin Delf was on the team. This would have been in 78 when they went to the Final Four. And, oh, it was sometime around Christmas. I was in Fayetteville for a game, and it was obvious that they were really good. And, you know, they'd done well the previous year, lost in the NCAA tournament to Wake Forest in Norman. And so everybody was, you know, on the bandwagon. And, of course, Conway was just going crazy over Marvin. And I, you know, I just couldn't give him enough. And Eddie suggested that I do a diary with Marvin after every game. Well, I was like, well, Coach, I'm not, you know, I'm going to cover Conway High and UCA and Hendricks. I'm not going to be, but every once in a while, be at a Fayetteville game. And he says, no. He says, we fly home. We go on these, you know, small charter private planes, and we'll be back the night before after every game. And Marvin's up. He's an early riser. He's up at 7:30. You know, we were an afternoon paper, which meant we had to be finished with our work about 11 a.m. every morning for a daily paper. And he says, I'll tell Marvin just to go back to his room at 8 o'clock every morning after the games, right after breakfast, before he starts to class, and you can call him. And they gave me Marvin's dorm number. But that was his idea, kind of a gift to me and a gift to the people of Conway, and Marvin thought it was great. Never missed one of those phone calls. We had him after every game and had a little boxed story, you know, to lead the sports section, Log Cabin Democrat, you know, how Marvin did the night before, a diary, you know, and he'd give me his words. And I mean, you don't think that was big. Can you imagine a coach giving access to his, to a player now like that? I mean, that, but he just recognized the media was important.
Yeah. And one of the things that Eric Musselman has been given, I don't know if it's the exact same type of appreciation from media members, but whether it's calling him by name, it seems like he's willing to do almost any interview, whether it's a podcast that 20 people listen or coming on our radio show. It seems like, similar to what you're talking about with Eddie Sutton, Mus doesn't mind showing the media some love as well, Clay.
Yeah, I mean, it's important in the way you build your program that you take it to the people. And the media's, he, Eddie Sutton understood that, as does Eric Musselman, in that, you know, the key in both situations is if you win. And you win, you don't mind being open and everything. It's when the losing starts it all at once, it's like you're uncomfortable. And I think that you've got to be, you know, confident in your own skin. You've got to be comfortable that you're going to win. That it's if you, you don't want people around when you're losing. Just yeah. Trust me, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the flights back, and that made me think of the time when those that were lost at Oklahoma State and those plane right. crashes. And, you know, for all the Final Fours and all the success, Clay, I don't think anything changed or maybe even defined part of Coach Sutton's legacy more than the way that program responded and what he went through when those planes went down following that. I think they were coming back from Colorado from a game there and flying back to Stillwater. I think you can't really tell the story and of Eddie Sutton without telling that part of the story too, because while that didn't happen at Arkansas, that was a big part of his career.
So he made the personal phone calls to every family member, you know, to the moms and the dads, to tell them. And you know, it was pretty incredible. That really changed the way everybody did business. You know, for years, the basketball teams, they used private planes. In other words, they'd pick out three donors in Arkansas for those three planes. One might be a school plane. They had a small plane, you know, a King Air or something. And they'd get three like that to take, you know, 20 members of the team. You know, they'd divide it up. Well, after that crash, all the top elite programs, you know, either they went commercial or they chartered, you know, one of those 40-seat, you know, like regional jets. And that just changed the way everybody did business. Were they not going to put it on a, you know, on a private plane to get them in and out of places? That just, you know, if you couldn't go, you know, with a regional jet or commercial, you just like that, then don't put your team at risk like that.
Let's get into some Eddie Sutton stories from his former players. We've had the privilege again of having Cindy Moncrief, Joe Klein, U.S. Reed. And we talked about this with Joe, 1984. He's on the U.S. Olympic team with Michael Jordan and so many other great players. And he talked about he came back to campus thinking he was the man, the guy. Well, Eddie Sutton, he set him straight.
I just got back from the Olympics, and, you know, and I was walking around campus, and, you know, nothing stank, and I was the man, and, you know, I think we were in practice, you know, guys coming down the lane, and I bailed out. I didn't step in and take it, and again, as we talked earlier, there were five or six things defensively for Coach Sutton that you were going to do. I mean, it was, you're not bailing out on a charge. And so, you know, he lined everybody up on the left, and I had to slide across the lane to the block and take a hit. And then he lined them all the way up on the right. I had to slide across to the right and take a hit from everybody on both sides of the floor. And then he just kind of looked over at me and he goes, I just wanted to make sure that you know that gold medal doesn't keep you from taking a hit in the chest and falling down and taking a charge. And I was like, no, sir. And so from then on, if I was walking through the BA and somebody bumped into me, I was going down.
A coach's relationship with his best player or her best, his or her best player, whatever, is very important to the overall makeup of the team. And at the time, most people would say Joe was the best player on that basketball team, depending on the year. And you think about coming back when you're really glorified as one of the best basketball players in the country, going to the Olympics, but Coach Sutton was like, no, you're going to still do the blue-collar stuff we do here at Arkansas, or you're not going to see the floor.
Well, he had a way of coaxing the best out of you. When I say coaxing, I mean that's a mild word from what he did. But he demanded that you do everything that was laid out in the program. And again, you know, the way they moved defensively and the way they denied the passing lane and the weak side help and the positioning, the way you moved your feet. I mean, you got into a stance. And you stayed in a stance. You know, that's one of the things that I noticed about Musselman's team. Man, they get in a defensive guard and stance, and that's the way it is. And you see some teams, and there'll be three guys in stance, and there'll be two guys standing straight up. When I see that, I learned from watching Eddie Sutton. When I see a guy standing straight up on defense on any team that comes into Bud Walton Arena, I know the coach doesn't have total control of the team. And you don't see that with Musselman's teams, and you certainly didn't see that with Eddie Sutton's teams. They guarded you, and they got in a guarding stance.
And the defense, because you mentioned it, Clay, we talked about it in your article that you wrote a little while back when Eddie Sutton was selected to the Hall of Fame, how teams didn't want to play his teams because they denied the ball. They got after you, and they were in the passing lane, so it was very hard to score on them. And that's like blue collar in your face defense has been very important. I mean, there's different styles. Nolan's style was a lot different from Eddie's style, but it came back to tough physical defense. The center point of it was tough physical. Now, they did it different ways. Eddie more of half court, guard your man like straight up, and then Nolan's fastest 40 minutes of hell. That was what they did, different ways. But really, I mean, it started with defense. Their offense a lot of times was created based on how well they played defense. Both coaches.
Yep, you did not get away with a straight line dribble to the basket. It just wasn't going to happen. I mean, you see teams give up a straight line dribble to the basket. That means they have no defensive concept. Eddie Sutton's team, first of all, they made you with the ball turn your back to the basket. You were not going to be able to face up to the basket because they're going to take the ball away from you. And so they made you turn your back to the basket with the ball, and they did not allow straight line dribble to the basket. In other words, you take the ball wherever you are in the position, you get it, and you drive straight to the basket. They didn't allow that. It didn't happen. And so when you saw that, maybe with a John Pelfrey team or a Stan Heath team, the old-time fans, it just take the air out of you. It's like they just allowed a straight line dribble to the basket. What hadn't happened? Mm-hmm. Nolan's teams didn't allow that. They were the Henry Iba positioning. Now, they might trap and do some things to give up, you know, a pass to the weak side for an open shot with the trap. But they did not allow straight line. I mean, you, Corey Beck, Clay McDaniel, you try to make a straight line drive on those guys, they took it away from you and dunked it on the other end. And that's the core of playing defense. And Eddie Sutton's teams were so mentally tough and would be in a guarding position. And that's the key. If you're standing straight up, somebody's going to blow by you. If you're in a guarding position and you can move laterally, they're not going to get a straight line drive.
We can talk about defensive schemes and concepts, but how about how he controlled his scheme? Whether it was getting in you, putting a hug around you, it was very cool to read and watch how he controlled his basketball teams. We had U.S. Reed on a month or so ago, and he told us how Eddie Sutton conducted his way as the head basketball coach.
Playing for Coach Sutton, it was like walking into a big corporation and you have all these guys in business suits and you're playing for a big CEO. I mean, he we would come down and practice and he had each assistant coach over a certain station. You know, he had the guards over here, the forwards over there, the center, the fours and the fives over here, and everybody would be going over individual assignments and skill sets and how to pass, how to post up, how to rebound, and practice would be going on, and he would even be there, really. And he'd come down late, and he'd walk around, and he'd observe each station. You know, he let those assistant coaches do their jobs, and he had the best assistants in the country. I mean, they were really good at skill training, getting everybody ready to play the game.
Clay, in your article with Coach Dickey, he referenced the different drills and, like, the post-defense and how U.S. Regis laid it out, where there were so, like, the assistants had so many different stations that they would work on during practice. We've heard about the detail of Eric Musselman's practice from different coaches, different college basketball analysts, and whoever. This wasn't as publicized because the media and stuff wasn't as out there on social media, but it seems like Eric Musselman's practices, it seems like Eddie Sutton's practices were highly detail-oriented and how he conducted it.
Yeah, and just Pat Foster explained to me the way he trained his coaches to do different jobs during the game, and that they watched the detail of the defensive sets, and that Eddie would watch the ball side, wherever the ball was. He's watching defensive players. The two defensive players that are on that side to make sure they were denying passing lanes, penetration, that their positioning, their footwork was exactly right. So he would watch the ball side. Then he would have another coach, whether it be Pat Foster or Gene Cady, would watch the perimeter defense, the movement of their feet. You know, so if there was something off, they call a timeout, and they, you know, that coach would get that fixed. And then another coach, say it's Foster or Katie are doing that, they would watch the weak side two defenders. So they had Coach Sutton watch the own ball defense, another coach would watch the perimeter defense, and another coach would watch the weak side. And the positioning had to be down. A pass would make, you'd shuffle your feet, you would change your positioning slightly, so that always all passes from the ball, all four passes to the other players on the floor were denial. There was no way you could make a pass. And that they watched the movement of their five defensive players with intensity, and at any timeout they could correct or substitute based on the position of their feet, and they would get it corrected, get it fixed, or you're out of the game.
Yeah.
But it was the detail and the way he assigned the different vision aspects of the defense to his assistant coaches.
And this was all done at a time where film study was primitive compared to today. Now you log into a computer, you can watch it anywhere on a phone, tablet, computer. You can watch Huddle, or you can watch Synergy is what the colleges use, and look at film and slow-mo and all. You had to get out a film projector back then, Clay.
Yeah, you did.
You didn't have VHS tape back
16
then.
16 millimeters.
So the scouting for all of that was, it's amazing how much they accomplished considering the lack of film study you were able to pull off.
Yeah, and you know what? I've been in some of his film study. He allows sometimes somebody to come in and sit down, and he'd coach the media. And that's one of the other aspects that we forget, how he wanted everybody that covered his team to understand how they were covering. And you could watch practice. His practices were open. You could sit in Barnhill and watch, and it was. I'm not sure I ever watched a three-hour practice. James said 3 hours. Maybe I left or came in, before it was over, got out of there. But yeah, it was incredible. You know, my brother was the sports information director when Coach Sutton was here, and he would tell me stories about him speaking at Razorback clubs and how charming. So there was another aspect to the way he explained his program to the fans that was just terrific. And then I don't think you can talk about Coach Sutton without talking about Mrs. Sutton Patsy. And she had the ability to be the master psychologist. If there was somebody like a Darrell Walker or an Alvin Robertson that, maybe Coach Sutton is really putting it on him pretty hard, she could kind of make him feel better and talk to him about the grand scheme and how they were going to win and what that was going to mean and their future and their careers. And so that he had all the bases covered, Tommy. I mean, it was just fascinating to watch. And
that's why he's all the famer.
Yeah, and sometimes we just look at it and think, well, that's the way it's supposed to be, but that's not the way all the coaches were. They didn't have all the bases covered. I mean, and it was but I tell you what, he had some good players too, and you look through and see how many of his guys played in the NBA. Almost as many of his guys played in the NBA as Nolan's guys. So I it's his ability to recruit and then develop. It was pretty incredible to watch.
Speaking of those NBA guys, Sidney Moncrief also had him on, and we've talked
maybe his best player ever.
Yeah, we've talked about how not only his attention to detail during practice, but what did he provide former players outside of practice, off the court? Sidney touched on that.
He's a builder of people. I think a lot of times we look at coaches as just basketball coaches. We don't see their impact off the court. And I would say Coach Sutton really emphasized academics, being a good person, being selfless off the court and on the court. He's more impressive as a person and as a people builder than his resume as a coach. And I think that's overlooked.
Clay, as Tommy said, that's his best player ever. Not talking now, he touched on some of the stuff that Coach Sutton did for him on the court, but that's also important because Sidney Moncrief, his best player ever, is also talking about how he excelled with players off the court. And we'll close down with this. We had Seth Greenberg on a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about how important basketball coaches' wives are to the team and the program. Talked about how important Danielle Musselman was for balance. It seems like that Mrs. Sutton was just as important for them, on not only on the court but off the court as well, because she provided that balance not only with the education but helping out players if he was getting on to them a little bit. So really great stuff from a bunch of former Arkansas players under Eddie Sutton. You've heard Clay's perspective. You've heard James Dickey's perspective. You've also heard some great players' perspective as well.
You're listening to the Bud Light Seltzer Morning Rush Podcast. Try the new Bud Light Lemonade, a light and flavorful beer for those easy drinking occasions.
The crowd's into it. They just threw him out of the game. He's gotten his second technical, and he's been thrown out of the ball game.
All right, let's welcome in former Arkansas assistant, longtime assistant under Eddie Sutton, also the head coach of Texas Tech in Houston. He went 30-2 in 1996 with the Texas Tech Red Raiders. Coach James Dickey now joins us. Coach, good morning. Thanks for making some time for us. There was a recent article that Clay wrote when Eddie Sutton was selected for the Hall of Fame, and he talked to you and he talked to some others. And I found it fascinating that when you're watching Coach Sutton's television show on Sunday nights, you sent him letters trying to get on the staff. What really got you thinking, hey, I want to coach for this guy?
Well, good morning, guys. Ty, Tommy, and Clay, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm honored that you would have me on. It was really interesting to me when I graduated from college at the University of Central Arkansas. I just really wanted to get a high school job. And my dad, he was a smart guy. He said, there's a guy over there at Arkansas named Eddie Sutton that's a pretty good coach. And he said, you ought to think about getting your master's and see if you could learn some basketball from him. So that started a five-year program for me trying to get on with Coach Sutton. Luckily, at the time, I got on with Coach Jess Busey at Harding and got my master's at Harding University. And then I watched Coach Sutton shows every Sunday night with a notepad and wrote him a letter every year for 5 years. And thanks to my great friend, Jimmy Counts, who's now a doctor in Northwest Arkansas, I was able to finally get on with Coach Sutton in 1981.
Coach, one of the things about coaching, there's a fine line between grilling a guy for making a mistake or knowing when to kind of embrace him and hug him and or just be kind of more softer tone. And you mentioned in this article that Eddie Sutton was masterful at that. How was he so good at conducting, dealing with former player or with players?
Well, first of all, he cared about his players tremendously, and he always felt like that players would accept constructive criticism. They'd accept coaching if they knew you cared about them, and he always cared about his players, not only on the floor but off the floor as well, about their families. He and Miss Sutton were both very big on education. They wanted the players to do well in school, strive for their degrees, and that was always important. So the players knew that he cared about them, but he just had that uncanny ability to know when to really constructively criticize a guy or to put his arm around him, and he could get maximum results both ways.
Coach, there's very few people we could have on the show to give us some real perspective about Coach. I mean, a lot of people are going to ask basketball questions. Fill in some cracks. Give the audience more detail about who Eddie Sutton was as a person, because no one spent probably more time professionally with him than you did.
Well, Coach Sutton was, he grew up as an only child in Buckland, Kansas. And so he grew up around some great coaches that were at Kansas, and obviously Mr. Iba at Oklahoma State. He was a very good player. He played against Wilt Chamberlain. He talked about that game a lot because I guess he was sick, but had one of his best games against Wilt Chamberlain when he was at Kansas, and then just became a great student of the game. And the one thing that's very interesting, other than his year as a graduate assistant to Mr. Iba, Coach Sutton was never an assistant coach to anyone. He became the head coach at Tulsa Central High School, then went to Southern Idaho, did a great job, came to Creighton, Arkansas, Kentucky, and then back to his alma mater. But he was never an assistant coach, and I always thought one of the things that was fascinating about that is he really knew how to inspire his assistant coaches, and he's produced so many head coaches over the years. When you look back at his great staff that he assembled when he first came to Arkansas, and, which I thought was one of the best decisions he ever made, was to keep Coach Pat Foster on the staff. And Coach Foster did a great job and went on to become a very successful head coach, Gene Katie. And then, of course, Bill Self, who's a Hall of Famer, who's an assistant coach. But he's had others, that Dwayne Casey, who's the head coach of the Detroit Pistons now, who was at Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton, who's at Florida State. So he just had some great assistant coaches, and he understood how to handle assistants, even though he'd never been one. That was always pretty amazing for me.
Did he ever tell you what attracted him to the Arkansas job? Because when he was at Creighton and came to Arkansas, the Arkansas program was not in very good shape, and it had seen some real low times, and Coach Sutton was the one that turned that around. What did he ever tell you what attracted him to come to this job at Arkansas when he did?
That's a great question. You guys have really got some very interesting questions. Clay probably knows this, but Coach Sutton had interviewed with Coach Broyles about the Arkansas job before and actually turned it down the first time when he was at Creighton. And then Coach Broyles went back to him the second time, and he felt like that there was finally going to be a commitment to the Razorback basketball program, even though Coach Van Eemen had the running Razorbacks and had them rolling. He wanted to go to a different level, and he felt like there was a commitment there. And obviously, it started out when they made the transformation of Barnhill Arena from where it was to what it became. And so he felt like that, as he always called it, it was a sleeping giant.
James, I want to move to his coaching, and that's always what I like to do is talk when you're talking about Coach Sutton. And you told me a story when I asked you about his defense and what made it tick, and you referenced another great coach. Just tell us the Charlie Spoonauer take on Coach Sutton.
Well, Coach Spoonauer is a great person, great coach, unbelievable speaker, and just extremely smart, and had a connection with Coach Sutton because he had worked with Mo Iba at Nebraska, and Coach Spoonauer did a terrific job at what is now Missouri State. It used to be Southwest Missouri State, but what's now Missouri State. And Coach Sutton had wanted to play regional schools in home and home situations, and he wanted to talk to Coach Spoonauer and had me call him about playing. That was a really short conversation, Clay, because when I talked to Coach Spooner, he was very cordial, and he was always very nice to me. But he goes, why would I want to play a team that won't let you pass and catch? And I thought that was a great compliment, because if you remember the way that we played tremendous pressure on the ball and denied one pass away, and I thought that was a great compliment to Coach Sutton by Coach Spooner by saying, they won't even let you pass and catch the ball, so we're not interested in playing you.
Yeah. Eventually, y'all did play him, and there were some great games.
They did. Coach Sutton played. I'm not sure he played when, but he did. He had a great relationship with the people. Bill Rowe was the athletic director at Missouri State at the time, and Coach Sutton had a relationship with it developed with John Q. Hammonds in Springfield. So we did play them, and I went on and played them, not when Coach Spoonauer was there,
but I think it was Cleveland
four times when I went to Tech. So it was always a good relationship and a good regional rivalry.
James, we tend to focus on defense when you think of Coach Sutton, but his offense ability to coach in his system, of course, there's no shot clock. Just kind of detail what y'all did and what y'all worked on in practice that y'all took to the game as far as offensive strategy.
Well, that's a great point, Clay, because when you look back at as we look at basketball today, when you have the shot clock and the three-point line, which were two of the obviously huge changes during my career, but we won the Southwest Conference Championship in 1982, actually sealed it at SMU on the road. There was no shot clock. There's no three-point line. But what he convinced players to do, and none more evident than 78 when he had the triplets, and all three of those guys could have scored a bunch of points, but he was able to convince them to play within their roles, and he always emphasized not only to coaches but to the players about understanding what your role is on the team, and he was strong in his conviction about taking care of the basketball offensively, not turning it over. Shot selection was huge for him to understand players. What was a good shot, and it might not be what's a good shot for one player might not be a good shot for the other player. So there was certainly a lot of teaching that was going on. There was a lot of counseling for players to understand which shot they should take. And my dad, you know, is one of the most difficult things for players, but he was able to convince them to do that. And then I thought he was a master at teaching the passing game. And one of the things that's interesting today, when you watch the game, everybody wants to run a ball screen. Everybody's going to talk about how you're going to defend the high pick and roll, how you're going to defend the side ball screen. Early on at Arkansas, we never screened on the ball. We always would pass and cut or pass and go away. We didn't do a lot of ball screen. That was one of his rules in the motion offense. But he was able to get players to be very disciplined on the court. He was a great teacher of the game. But as you mentioned, Clay, it all started on the defensive end. But he knew offense as well.
Coach James Dickey with us on the Morning Rush, longtime Eddie Sutton assistant, former head coach of Texas Tech in Houston. Coach, you were a part of a couple really big wins at Arkansas, and we've talked about these pretty extensively. The win against Michael Jordan in North Carolina in Pine Bluff, and the win over Hakeem Olajuwon in Houston in Barnhill Arena. Of those two games, which win do you appreciate more?
That'd be a tough question because I can remember the game in Pine Bluff so vividly that, you know, we drew up the play for Alvin Robertson, Doc Sadler, who is another great coach that spent a lot of time with Coach Sutton and has been the head coach at UTEP, Nebraska. Southern Miss, Doc had the scout on that game, and Charles Ballantyne hit the shot. And, you know, you remember it's close to Valentine's Day. And then Scott Hastings hit the shot against over the outstretched arms of Hakeem Olajuwon in Barnhill. Both were great. Both were great victories and big wins. I guess when you look at it, you go back historically. The win against Carolina was big because they were number one. They were undefeated. And what's so when you go back, and I know it's been several decades, almost. 35 years, those games were played on Sunday on national television after you'd already played conference games on Wednesday and Saturday. And just one interesting tidbit about that particular game, we played A&M on Wednesday night in College Station and just barely eked out a win on the road. Then played SMU, who was very, very good. They had John Konkak, had a great team. We played really well on Saturday afternoon and won in Dallas. And then we had terrible weather. I actually had left Dallas and went to Cushing, Oklahoma to watch Stephen Moore play, and went back to Fayetteville and was going to meet the team in Pine Bluff the next day, and the team couldn't get out because of storms. Mm-hmm. And it was really rough on Sunday morning. They had a charter plane that flew into Pine Bluff, actually landed 1 hour. At 1 hour before tip-off, and you know, everyone talks about the scouting report and the preparation. Team actually got there, got dressed. Coach Sutton had time to get the guys warmed up a little bit, write five starters on the board, who they were going to guard, and then we went and played the game. And just a tremendous game. I can remember Joe Klein had, you know, it was 10-for-10 from the free throw line. Daryl Bedford had a big game, and then obviously Charles hit a huge baseline shot, and then. If you remember, Clay will remember this. They ran a play at the end of the game. Dean Smith threw the ball to half court, called timeout. We did a good job covering Michael, but we left Steve Hale wide open from the corner. Steve Hale was from Tulsa, who Jimmy Counts had recruited really, really hard. And Steve, he was wide open in the corner, and luckily for us, missed the shot and came off on the weak side. But just a little history behind that game, which was a really big win.
Coach Sutton's teams were 120-8 in games played in Fayetteville. That's nearly 94% of the time Coach Sutton's teams won at Barnhill. What made his team so special and so lethal in Fayetteville?
That's one of the neat things for me, was to be able to, first of all, be a part of Coach Sutton and that staff. Fred Trinkle was there. Bill Brown was there. Jimmy Counts was there. Doc Sadler was there. Jimmy Dykes was there at the time. So we had some, you know, just wonderful people to be around.
But Coach Sutton really talks about that home court advantage, and obviously the relationship that he developed with Jim Robkin and the Hogwild Band, and that place was really special. But the fans, the enthusiasm of the fans, the way that they would show up for the games, and Coach Sutton talked about educating the fans on understanding, you know, how to help your team win at home. But our teams played with terrific confidence, and he would always tell them in the huddle, hey, somebody's going to make a big play, somebody's going to get the momentum going. And but the home court advantage was a combination of things. Obviously, the great players that we had made a huge difference, but the crowd, the band, the atmosphere was really important as well.
James, tell us about an Eddie Sutton practice. Just what was a 2 hour or whatever? I don't know how long y'all practiced. But.
Hey, I wasn't thinking about 2 hours. First word that came to my mind was long practices, and I will just give you an example about that. I don't remember very rarely ever having a 2 hour practice. Now, yeah, they have practice restrictions now, the hours where you have the number of hours you can practice in a day, the number in a week, and you have to take the mandatory day off. I can remember, Clay, many, many years, the first we started practicing on October the 15th at that time, the first day we would have off was Christmas break. Coach Sutton didn't believe in days off, and he believed in working, but normally we'd practice 3 hours a day. He loved practice. He loved the teaching. The majority of time was spent on defensive drills in the defensive end of the court. And he spent a lot of time. He was a great tactician, great teacher, but we spent a lot of time. And I will tell you, he stuck with that because the year between when I was at Tech and before I rejoined him at Oklahoma State, I actually did I worked with John Holcomb out of Tulsa, and we did television for the Cowboy Sports Network. And I went in to watch the practice before the last conference game of the season in 2001. They were playing A&M on Saturday evening when he was having a practice. And I thought, well, this would be a short practice day before the game. Be 1 hour and a half. He went 3 hours the day before the game. So he believed in working, believed in long practices. He believed in guys being mentally tough. And we were going to work when you came to practice. I mean, once the – He didn't like the stretching. The strength coaches did a great job stretching, getting guys. He didn't like the warm-ups. When he got ready to go to the drills, he'd step on the floor. When he blew that whistle, we went to work, and that's what it was for 3 hours.
Coach Dickey, let's end it with this question here, and we appreciate your time this morning. If Coach Sutton were able physically, and if he was with us still and able to give the speech, and his health was not good at the end, what would he have said at his Hall of Fame induction speech? Because I think we all got robbed out of a great final Eddie Sutton speech. What do you think would have been on his agenda that day?
Well, I won't speak completely for him, but I will say this. First of all, I think it would be very elegant, eloquent. He had he was a masterful speaker, did a great job. He could command a room. He could command an audience. But he'd thank his family. There's no doubt about that, the support that Miss Sutton and the boys had given him over the years. But he'd thank his players, loved his players dearly. He would thank them, certainly thank all the fans and people that influenced him and supported him at every stop that he made. And he would thank the people that gave him the opportunities along the way. He'd obviously speak about Mr. Ivan, speak about Coach Broyles, Cliff Hagan, and just the different people that, and Mr. Ivan, who helped bring him back to Oklahoma State. And Coach Sutton would be thankful for the game of basketball because he had great respect for the game, and he talked about what it had done for him and for his family. And I just think that'd be a few things that And obviously, he'd be very appreciative to the people that voted him into the hall.
Coach, one last question before we let you go. You went to school with our own Clay Henry. What was Clay like?
Wait a minute.
I'm going to tell you what. That guy was a great person and a great writer when he started out writing back at UCA and has continued to do well. He's not only become one of the great writers, but does radio with you guys. Does television. I understand that also, besides his family, he's become quite a great fly fisherman. And so most of us that...
have you seen it, or is that just what he's told you, Coach?
Well, I have not seen it in person, but I've heard good. I've heard very good things about it.
Legend, right, Coach? It's the legend.
They get those fish get bigger and bigger, especially as each year goes by, they get a little bit bigger.
Well, Coach, thank you for carving out some time for us this morning. James Dickey, former head coach of Texas Tech in Houston, longtime Eddie Sutton assistant. Coach, we really appreciate it.
Tommy, Ty, Clay, thank you guys for having me on. It's certainly been a pleasure and honor.
The battle of wits has begun. It ends when you decide and we both drink.
Come on, you gotta be kidding me.
That's a tough choice.
How can you know all that?
There's just so many options.
Hey, would you rather...
Clay, you've yet to play this game before. I know many of our listeners know, but for our listeners that are hearing this for the first time and you who have yet to play, Jenkins is going to give us a question with two options, and you have to pick one or the other. There's no backdoor. There's no I'm not going to do either. You got to pick one or the other, bud. Some will be tailored towards all of us, and some will be tailored directly towards you. So.
Yeah, I want to warn you, you know, Bart used to do this kind of stuff with me, not exactly like this, and he says, you got to do this or you got to do, I don't mean this particular game, and I wouldn't do it. I just made it the way I wanted it to make it.
Well, you'll have fun with the question I have in mind for you here just in a little bit.
So when you're 65, you just do what you want to. I mean, there's not anybody left that can make me do what they want me to do. I do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So I warn you, your game might get distorted a little bit. But
I think Mrs. Jean Ann would have something to say about that, Clay.
Yeah.
That's the only person that can do that.
Maybe we should get her on the program so she can play that with us. Yeah.
No, we don't let her listen.
Okay. All right, Jenkins, get him rolling.
That.
All righty, boys.
Talker.
Would you rather, as a fan, have never let Bobby Petrino leave, Houston Nutt leave, or Lou Holtz leave Arkansas? Basically, which coach would you rather have stuck around?
Yeah, there were issues with all three of those. I would probably say Houston Nutt.
Because you've talked about the recruiting deficiencies that Lou Holtz had in his time, right? And I know...
Yeah, I mean, he was getting wiped out in Central Arkansas. You know, the black athlete was... He just did not have the knack of figuring out what to do with in the living room, how to win. I mean, when you think about not getting... Keith Jackson, Eric Mitchell, I could go on and on. Danny Bradley, you know, these are guys, and some of them actually, you know, signed when Ken Hatfield had just arrived, but Lou had already lost him. Leslie O'Neal, I mean, not recruiting Leslie O'Neal, a Hall of Famer, went to Oklahoma State. It's just a disaster.
I would say Houston as well, Clay. I'll agree with you. I think Bobby Petrino, we've seen in his coaching career that he can't last more than 4 or 5 years, and then the program that he leaves it in wake. So I would also go, while that might sound weird to some of you listeners that might think Houston Nutt is the lesser of the three coaches we just listed, it seems like that he would probably be better for Arkansas long-term than both Petrino and Lou Holtz.
He was here 10 years, so I think that is pretty well long-term. Since we've been talking Hall of Fame coaches, I'll go with Holtz. All of the reasons that Clay just laid out are obviously concerning, but you'd hope he could find the right assistant, find the right coordinator, find the right somebody to fix that recruiting problem. But the only Hall of Famer out of that bunch is Lou Holtz, so I'll go with the Hall of Famer.
Would you rather take quarterback lessons from Chad Morris or take smiling lessons from John L. Smith?
John L. Smith smiling lessons, because he had a knack for that, and he's fantastic at it.
You know, John L.'s personality was wonderful, and it was just a joy to be around him. And I know that you get, you know, little sound bites of John L., but his fatherly talks walking off the field with me, I mean, he'd put his arm on my shoulder and would start talking about things. I mean, he would want to know about my family and where my daughters were, you know, in college and different. And then he, all at once, he just felt like, well, he's giving you some really good advice here. So I enjoyed John L. Smith. And I'll say some of this was when he was an assistant coach, you know, during this time when he was on Petrino's staff. The fans were so frustrated with that season and how things turned out and that Petrino was gone. But John L. Smith was he was a lot of fun to be around.
John L., I'll make it three. Out of three.
There we go. So there's been rumors swirling of like Major League Baseball needing venues. They've been talking about playing in Phoenix or Florida. The NBA probably playing in Disney World. So I'll frame it this way. Would you rather see an NBA tournament or games at Bud Walton Arena or a batch of MLB games at Baum Walker Stadium?
Give me the NBA games in Bud Walton Arena every day of the week.
Yeah, Sunday. This just comes down to whether you're a basketball fan or a baseball fan. I think if you said a Cardinals game at Baum Stadium, our audience would overwhelmingly want a Cardinal game at Baum Stadium. So I think it just comes down to which one you're a fan of. It's warm weather. Give me the baseball at Baum Stadium.
I think that I'll go with basketball at Bud Walton. And the reason I say that, there won't be enough seats at either place. But there's 20,000 opportunities for people to come in Bud Walton to watch an NBA game. So I think that's the better venue of the two. Not putting down Baum Walker, but I'm just going to tell you, 10,000 seats, you know, counting people putting in the outfield, there's not enough room there to get all the people that would want to see that game.
Sweet. So let's we'll transition away from Arkansas for a sec. Would you rather win the Masters and get the green jacket or stand in the confetti after winning the Super Bowl?
Green jacket, 100 out of 100.
I take the green jacket because my golf game is so grotesque. It would be such a...
Both are life-changing events. Now, when you say stand in the confetti, I assume you are on the winning team. Yep. I assume you're not just there as, you know, you're schlepping around a camera for the NFL Network or something. I'll take the Masters every time.
There's just a feeling around seeing someone in the green jacket that means it. Not that lifting the Vince Lombardi trophy isn't significant or being in one of those pictures, but there's an extra level, I think.
And you get to play there for a lifetime. Until you no longer want to be in the field, you get to play in the Masters every year the rest of your life. That's another cool thing.
Yeah, first of all, you could have taken it up a step. The question really wasn't that good.
Oh,
it wasn't close.
Thank you, Clay.
This is what we need Clay here for.
So the question should have been,
all right,
you were the MVP of the Super Bowl. You're standing in the confetti. They've just said, say your line. I'm going to Disney World. And so now you've put it in a different perspective. You know, there's the trophy, the Super Bowl trophy. There's the MVP trophy. There's all the trimmings. That's what you got with putting the green jacket on. You've won. So you compared one. Okay, you played in the Super Bowl. Well, you could compare that to, okay, you played at the Masters. No, you said put the green jacket on, so there's no choice. You didn't give us a choice, Matt. You know, you've got to make it apples to apples as close as you can. So,
well, he's got 17 questions here, and we've gotten through four.
Well,
so
here, well,
let's see if we can get
go. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. No, here's apples to apples for you. Here, this is just for you, Clay. Would you rather be a Texas fan for one football season or go trout fishing with a spinning rod, corn, and red worms?
Oh, I'll go spinning fishing. I don't care. I mean, I can enjoy fishing, and the river was designed for a lot of different people. The world was not designed for anybody to be wear burnt orange. Hey, I saw a burnt orange truck the other day, and road rage came upon me for a few seconds, and my wife says, easy, big boy, easy.
Oh, Lordy. All right, Ty, here's yours. Would you rather see Tommy grow out his hair like you did or see Phil do the same?
Can Phil? That would be. Is Phil physically capable of that?
I don't like making fun of Phil's hair, but since you presented me the question, he would have a Dana Holgerson type look, or he would have it grown out the back, but there wouldn't be in
gross.
Front. Yeah, I think most listeners would probably like to see Tommy Weathersport, because Phil, I think, could not necessarily pull it off from the hair perspective, but like his vibe is more like long hair. I don't, Tommy, you don't really present the chill long hair vibe, so I would probably go you just to see.
What's the word you? I think I could keep up with you when it comes to volume. That's a word you like to use with your hair. Is
volume.
I've still got a pretty thick mane up here for mid 40s. So I think I could hang there when it comes to volume.
I think I commend you. You have good hair for your age, though. And I'd like to see you grow it out a little bit.
for my age.
Tommy, would you rather see Ty as the Bachelor for a season or have Ty be one of the Bachelors on a season of The Bachelorette?
Well, neither one are realistic because you got to be far better looking than Ty is.
Do you pay me if I get an audition?
Do I
get paid if I stay there for like 9 weeks or whatever it is?
Are you going to do the show while you're there? I mean, I could work something out. You could still figure out a way to do the show. But
I got to have time to work out and flirt, too.
I think I would rather see him be the Bachelor because I think that would make him far more uncomfortable. I think he likes hanging out with the bros, with his dudes. So being in a house with 20 other guys or whatever it is, he'd be comfortable there. Being the one guy with 20 women, he would be totally uncomfortable with that.
You know, I'll say something to that. There's not many good things associated with the coronavirus right now. The one good thing I can say as a takeaway is when a cute girl walks by now, I have a built-in excuse not to talk to her because we have this going on. That's the one good
thing. You would be far more uncomfortable as the Bachelor.
No.
Right?
She has a built-in excuse not to talk to you.
Better way, yeah.
He just looks like he's got the Rona.
Yeah, so we were playing basketball the other day, and this is cute girl that always runs by, and I'm just like, man, thank goodness for the coronavirus. Yeah. Otherwise, I'd have to go talk to this broad. That's the only reason why.
I probably wouldn't start with the word broad. That probably would nix you right there.
Man. All right. We'll do one more quick one. If you had just won the lottery, would you rather relocate to an Oceanside cabana or stay in Arkansas and build a gigantic mansion?
I don't like the ocean that much. I'm staying in Arkansas building a fat mansion next to Donald W.
Right next door, huh?
Yeah.
I'm staying right here. I need more square footage than a cabana. Although
okay,
would be
guys.
Good.
So, good question, Matt. But
10
you
seconds,
know,
Clay.
I would take that lottery money, and I'd have a place in Aspen.
Ooh.
I'd have a place West Palm, and then I would have a place somewhere in Montana where no one would ever find me, and I would look like the Unabomber, but I'd be fly fishing.
Your number one source of local news and information you need.
Bud Light Seltzer, 5% ABV and only 100 calories. We'd put it up against any other seltzer out there.